Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, January 18th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It is Martin Luther King Day, ladies and gentlemen. Federal holiday in the United States. And yet we are here with a new show. Joining me as always, Emma Vigeland is here. Hello, Emma. How are you?
Hello, Sam. I am well.
Full disclosure, of course, we have pre-recorded this program on the program today. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the historian Gerald Horn from the University of Houston. We've had the professor on multiple times, who has written literally dozens of books on and most recently we have talked to him about the formation of, or I guess the prehistory of the United States and colonization and its relationship to slavery, and we will be talking to the professor about the legacy of Martin Luther King and how he is used in the current day, and how much of that obscures what Martin Luther King was actually attempting to achieve in this country. Obviously, over the course of several hundred years, we have progressed, but not nearly enough in terms of a society that even, I think, can pretend to have some type of egalitarian system and both inputs and outputs, frankly. But so, Emma, let's talk about this. You know, this story came out late on Friday afternoon, but is really a disturbing one. Right now, the sort of, I guess, the thing that I feel like everybody is holding on to in terms of looking forward, to seeing a light at the end of the tunnel, as we have an incredible increase in the number of infections and the rate of infection, and we have every reason to believe that variants of COVID-19, which are far more contagious, are already beginning to spread in communities around the country. And while this variant, and there's multiple variants.
Right, there's the Brazil one, there's the the UK one, and then
South African, I think there is one.
Right, right.
The point is not that they're necessarily more lethal per se, but that because they're that much more contagious, it's simply a matter of numbers. If you have 50% more, 60% more people who are infected, you're going to get 50 to 60% more deaths than you otherwise would have. And this is not a fixed rate of contagion. The nature of a pandemic is that they become exponential in their growth. And last week we reported that, and it was some contention, that the U.S. government was no longer going to withhold the second dose, both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccinations require two doses. Supposedly there's one in the works with Johnson & Johnson that is one dose, but I don't know how far down the road that is. So the Moderna and the Pfizer require two doses. The U.S. government was supposedly holding back on the second dose. of the
as claimed by Alex Azar of the Health and Human Services in the Trump administration. But now that there's only days left of the Trump administration,
last week, earlier in the week of last week, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar announced that the federal government would begin releasing coronavirus vaccine doses held in reserve for second shots. And the idea being that, well, it's better to get everybody with the first set of shots, and then we'll let the second shots come off the supply line. Well, according to the Washington Post and according to state and federal officials briefed on the distribution plans, no such reserve even existed. The Trump administration had already begun shipping out what was available beginning at the end of December, taking second doses directly off the manufacturing line. So over the past 3 days, over the weekend, and towards the end of the day on Friday, we were already getting announcements. We got it in New York City. I imagine this is something that existed around the country. We've run out. And the idea that with the billions of dollars set up, with Operation Warp Speed, with all of the talk of our mechanisms to produce these things, that we could run out of vaccinations so quickly into the process of vaccinating people is just stunning. And I say this because I want to go back to a speech that Biden made in Wilmington, Delaware on Thursday when he was talking about the coronavirus economic recovery plan. Well, let's hear what Joe Biden said and think about the implications of us having run out of the capacity to produce vaccines and what that may mean going forward in terms of what he's able to get through.
And so tonight, I'd like to talk to you about our way forward, a two-step plan of rescue and recovery, a two-step plan to build a bridge to the other side of the crisis we face, to a better, stronger, more secure America. Tonight, I'll lay out my first step, the American Rescue Plan, that will tackle the pandemic and get direct financial assistance and relief to Americans who need it the most. Next month, my first appearance before a joint session of Congress, I will lay out my Build Back Better Recovery Plan. It'll make historic investments in infrastructure, that Build Back Better plan, infrastructure, manufacturing, innovation, research and development, and clean energy, investments in a caregiving economy and skills and training needed by our workers to be able to compete and win in the global economy of the coming years. Moody's, an independent Wall Street firm, said my approach will create more than 18 million good-paying jobs. Our rescue and recovery plan is a path forward with both seriousness of purpose and a clear plan with transparency and accountability, with a call for unity that is equally necessary. And unity is not some pie-in-the-sky dream. It's a practical step to getting the things we have to get done as a country get done together. As I said when it passed in December, the bipartisan COVID-19 relief package was a very important first step. And I'm grateful for the Democrats, Republicans, and independent members of Congress who came together to get it done. But I said at the time, it's just a down payment. We need more action, more bipartisanship, and we need to move quickly. We need to move fast.
So, and now we have a situation where there is a deficit of vaccinations to move forward. And this is, I think, you know, going to be an opportunity for Biden to come out and increase the urgency of passing this bill. I mean, the fact is that he could, with the use of the Defense Production Act, he could essentially take over, more or less, or instruct private enterprise, if there are, and I imagine at this point they have investigated this, private enterprise to produce vaccinations. Now, of course, they would say, you know, you're going to get like a 3% profit or a 4% profit, whatever it is. But this needs to be roped in, it seems to me. And we should also point out, there also seems to be two separate bills he's talking about. In that speech in Delaware, he laid out the American Rescue Plan, which you know is $1.9 trillion. Now, I don't know. I haven't seen much reporting on this. But now he's talking about also laying out the Build Back Better plan in the first week of February. I think it's the first week of February that he's going to be addressing Congress for the first time, the joint session of Congress. So we could be looking at two separate plans. And it's going to be interesting to see in the coming days, particularly, you know, with this revelation that we have essentially run out of vaccinations. If he ties that in terms of a sense of urgency, what he can get passed through by regular means in a Senate in terms of a rescue plan, hoping that Republicans will come on board. You're going to need, 11 different Republicans, I think, to come on board to get through the Senate
fashion.
In a bipartisan fashion.
Yeah. But if that doesn't happen, he can get it through reconciliation.
He can get it through reconciliation. But he's talking about two separate bills. And it's, I think, going to be a harder lift. At least they're going to perceive it politically to do a, let's say the Build Back Better is another $1 trillion, to do a $2.9 trillion bill through reconciliation, as opposed to, and presumably, again, if we do it through reconciliation, it all has to be things that directly affect the budget of the United States.
But the COVID relief package, just so people realize what's in it, there are three big buckets of what's included. You have $400 billion for vaccines and for reopening schools and things dealing with COVID. Then you have around $1 trillion in direct relief to families, which includes unemployment and includes the stimulus checks. And then the third bucket is the $440 billion in other aid, which does include $350 billion for state and local. So that's the starting point where Biden wants to begin the negotiations. You're going to see conservative Democrats like Manchin, and then, of course, Republicans try to water that down, especially state and local aid. That's going to be a big lift.
Well, we will see what takes place. We're going to get a better sense of this stuff with each passing day as to who is lining up against this bill. It is going to be difficult, I think, for Republicans at this point to do it, but I don't know. We'll see.
Well, never underestimate the ability of Democrats to cave to Republicans.
Yeah, indeed. And the capacity for Republicans to obstruct.
Sure.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Professor Gerald Horn. He is the Moores Professor of History and African-American Studies at University of Houston. And we're going to be talking about Martin Luther King on this Martin Luther King Day. We'll be right back after this. Hey, folks, over the holiday season, we talked to you about GiveWell. It's the nonprofit that searches for charities where your donation helps the most. Well, in 2021, GiveWell is encouraging you to keep the giving spirit alive. Any listener who starts a new monthly donation by the end of February, you're going to have your first month matched up to $250. When you make a monthly donation, you commit to helping others all year by giving the most cost-effective charities GiveWell has found. Every month, you'll automatically work towards saving lives, preventing deadly disease, or helping those in extreme poverty. For me, personally, I give to Give Directly through GiveWell. I don't know that they're actually affiliated anyway, but just over the years from interviews that we've done and from research that I have read, giving directly, giving money who are living in money to people who are living in poverty, giving them money directly is the best way to fight poverty. I mean, we saw an example of this over the course of COVID when there was the $600 enhanced unemployment benefits. We had the lowest rate of poverty in this country that we had had in years. And folks know what to do with that money. So that's made, but there's other great charities there. And the thing that's great about GiveWell is that they assess dollar for dollar what how much impact is your dollar going to do? And so whether you're new to the GiveWell or already a donor, any listener who starts a new monthly donation by the end of February will have their first month matched up to $250. To have your donation matched, just go to givewell.org/majority, choose Give Monthly, and pick podcast and the Majority Report at checkout. It sounds a little more complicated than it is, but it's not. That's givewell.org/majority, select podcast, and the Majority Report at checkout. Also, it's finally a new year, and good riddance to 2020.
Jeez.
Although, I got to be honest, 2021, not necessarily up to speed quite yet.
We're talking fiscal years, I guess.
Exactly. Well, the perfect time to take your business, speaking of fiscal years, to the next level by hiring the right people is now. But finding qualified candidates can be very difficult. ZipRecruiter.com/majority makes it much, much easier. How do I know? Because I've used ZipRecruiter to hire Brendan.
Wow.
Yep. That was the last hire I needed. I didn't find you with ZipRecruiter, but I knew you.
Right.
When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent out to over 100 top job sites with just one click. And then what happens is ZipRecruiter's matching technology scans thousands of resumes and profiles to send you the most qualified people for your job. If you're really interested in one of the candidates that you find, you can even invite them to apply for your job. With one click, ZipRecruiter sends them an email from you and you stand out from the competition. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. Right now, you can go to ZipRecruiter for free. You can try it out, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. MAJORITY, majority. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Oh, and this company I'm very thankful for. I mean, obviously, I appreciate that they're sponsoring, but this is one of those stories where it's like, I was using this company, and then they approached us and said, can we advertise? I'm like, absolutely. So I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again. So my mom is getting up there in age and dealing with some challenges. And so we wanted, me and my sisters, were worried that she wasn't, cooking as much as she should be and eating as much as she should be. And so we set my mom up with Freshly. And Freshly, they have chef-made, nutrient-packed, delicious meals, and they deliver them right to your door.
Did I tell you I tried Freshly?
No, you didn't. But wait, let me finish the story.
Okay, sorry. I liked it a lot.
The problem is, we knew that my mom would be like, no, I'm not letting you pay for that. I'm not going to do that.
Right.
That's not necessary. So we told her that they were advertising and they were giving me
free
meals. And so my mom has been, for literally for the past year, it's like this, like almost every time I talk to her, I'm like, I got to thank you. The Freshly is so fantastic. And I keep telling people to buy their product because they're advertising on your show. And I feel great about it. And I would say, like, oh, well, that's great, Mom. I'm very happy. And so now I feel great because now they're actually advertising.
Yeah.
And so it's super easy to order. Freshly.com. You go there, you choose from over 30 meals. Steak peppercorn, Sasha's baked penne, chicken pesto bowl. What did you try?
I had the peppercorn steak, which was one of them. I had the bowl that was like chicken and quinoa, which I really liked. And there was a chicken one over kale. So anyway, the steak peppercorn, though, is probably my favorite because it comes with mashed potatoes that are good. It's hard for people to do mashed potatoes right. They did it right.
I didn't know that mashed potatoes
picky about mashed potatoes for some reason.
Well, check this out. Now our listeners can try Freshly for just $6.16 per meal. Your meals are ready to heat and enjoy in just 3 minutes. Right now, Freshly is offering our listeners $40 off your first two orders when you go to freshly.com/majority. Make eating better your New Year's resolution. Get a special limited time offer. Go to Freshly.com/majority for $40 off your first two orders. Try Freshly now, and for a limited time, get $40 off your first two orders. Go to Freshly.com/majority to learn more. Back to the show. So I'd like to welcome to the program Professor Gerald Horn, or I should say welcome back to the program, Professor Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn is the Moores Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, and his most recent book is The Bittersweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing. Professor Horn, welcome to the program, or welcome back, I should say.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So, I am curious as to, obviously today, Martin Luther King Day. When we look at the way that Martin Luther King is presented today, I mean, how much of a development, what has changed over the years in the way that we have celebrated, I guess, or look back on Martin Luther King's legacy?
Well, certainly in the spring of 1968, when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, it's fair to say that he was not necessarily as popular then, particularly amongst white Americans, as he apparently is today. I think there are a number of reasons for that. Certainly his anti-war stance, his opposition to the Vietnam War, was taken very seriously and was held against him. And then Martin Luther King Jr. was not opposed to associating with radicals who many felt should be marginalized and kept beyond the mainstream, not to mention the fact that the demonstrations and the mass protests that he oftentimes engineered were seen as very disruptive. So as one's life is taken, it oftentimes leads to a reassessment, or perhaps another way to put it is that after one is dead and buried, one becomes less dangerous.
Right. And that, I mean, that accounts for, I think, the, the initial reinterpretation of what he was fighting for. And I want to circle back to that. I'm curious, as in the interim time, do you have a sense that the perception of Martin Luther King has changed insofar as that maybe there is it feels to me, and maybe this is just more of a function of me, that over the past several years, there has been an increasing awareness of Martin Luther King's radicalism?
Well, I think that may be due to scholars, and I'm not sure how much that scholarly discourse has seeped into the mainstream. Scholars have basically just excavated the reality. For example, Martin Luther King had as a top aide Jack O'Dell, who had been a member of the Communist Party, had been a radical trade unionist. JFK took Martin Luther King into the Rose Garden to escape the prying eyes of the bulldog-like director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, instructing King to distance himself from Jack. Now, amongst many in the United States, that would be seen as quite a faux pas, to put it mildly, to associate with someone like Jack O'Dell, but it was not seen as a faux pas by Martin Luther King Jr. And I think that historians have done a fair job of trying to bring back these realities that I'm now describing.
Professor, can you talk about the conservative, reappropriation of Martin Luther King, or their usage of him, I guess I would say cynically, for their own ends, starting with Ronald Reagan creating Martin Luther King Day during his time as president?
Well, it struck me in reading the Washington Post about the tumult of January 6, 2021, that one of the recently arrested insurrectionists said it was no big deal because Martin Luther King had been arrested numerous times and he saw himself as walking in the footsteps of Martin Luther King Jr., which I found rather incredible because I dare say if this insurrectionist had been around in 1968, he would not necessarily be seeking to bathe himself in the glow of Martin Luther King Jr. But once again, after one is dead and buried, one is up for grabs in terms of historical reinterpretation. And given the fact that the Black community in particular has been resolute with regard to saluting Martin Luther King Jr., that has been a kind of North Star for the Black community generally. And I think it was perhaps inexorable that that particular attitude and approach would then begin to influence others.
I'm curious as to how, you know, in the absence of Martin Luther King, and like I said, I want to circle back and talk about his life and sort of what, but his legacy, I'm increasingly interested in the idea, the way that the United States chooses its icons, in the way what sometimes this does some work that functions in both directions. And I wonder in providing for a holiday recognition of Martin Luther King, to what extent America also wanted to deflate or to lessen the pressure of social movements in some way?
Well, I guess that's an argument that can be made. I tend to see it another way, which is that the Reagan administration, which was under tremendous pressure with regard to this national holiday, felt it necessary for its own political ends to accede to pressure generated by Congressional Black Caucus member John Conyers of Detroit, who carried the bill in Washington, Stevie Wonder, the entertainer and entrepreneur, who, of course, wrote a song about Martin Luther King and the birthday holiday, which then in many ways has supplanted the traditional happy birthday song we sing in the United States of America. But make no mistake, there was a bitter struggle, as you recall, in Arizona to get the governor there to accede to the King holiday. And of course, it required a boycott of Arizona to bring the authorities to their senses. Even in certain deep South states to this very day, there's a further swipe at the King holiday by calling it a Robert E. Lee Martin Luther King holiday, which is a kind of insult of a tremendous magnitude.
I don't think I was actually even aware of that, that there are states in this country that still refer to it as Robert E. Lee Martin Luther King Day?
Well, according to the New York Times, or at least one of these papers I read this morning, that's the case. You can, of course, ask Dr. Google to clarify that.
Yes, I will. All right. Well, let's talk about, some of Martin Luther King's radicalism. I mean, he seemed to be on a journey in the course of his life in terms of. That's the way, I guess, that I perceive it, as opposed to, can you talk about that in terms of, like, you know, to what extent that journey was a certain amount of discovery about the limitations, or I should say, the breadth of what he needed to advocate for, and how much of that was a new understanding, and how much of it was simply in some context, like a sequencing of what needed to be of where he felt the movement should go?
Well, I tend to see it as a deepening. And once again, oftentimes you can judge a figure like King by who this figure tends to associate with. Recall that there was quite a controversy about one of his early mentors and associates, speaking of Bayard Rustin, who had been a member of the Young Communist League, had been arrested because of homophobic laws. That was used in the halls of Congress by Dixiecrat Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, even making implications and imprecations about Dr. King's own sexuality. And then keep in mind as well that Martin Luther King did not desert another hero who you can compare to him. I'm speaking of the boxer Muhammad Ali, who, after he refused to step forward to be conscripted for the war in Vietnam, was deprived of earning his livelihood as a boxer during his peak earning years before a Supreme Court overturned the decision allowing him to return to the ring Dr. King stood by Muhammad Ali. And of course, Muhammad Ali is another example of how how the opinion of a certain figure can evolve, shall we say, because he was demonized as well for opposing the war in Vietnam. But by the time of his death, he was seen as a kind of cuddly teddy bear. And perhaps that had something to do with his debilities, the fact that he had a certain stage of Parkinson's towards the end, and his hands were oftentimes trembling. He oftentimes had difficulty speaking, and I guess that reduced the fearsome nature of his being. And now, of course, Muhammad Ali is seen as a kind of national hero, which would have been unimaginable in 1967.
I mean, I guess there is a quality. I mean, I feel like, Ali, in many respects, it was, you know, he and Cosell, Howard Cosell, sort of like created a phenom, and success in the ring, you know, sort of, I guess, in some respects, turned American American public opinion in Ali's favor. I mean, and I guess to a certain extent, that America, at least in modern history, has a tendency to appreciate people who have died more. I mean, honestly, like, Nixon's probably at his highest rating. Reagan probably at his highest rating after they have died. There just seems to be and maybe that is a phenomenon that goes outside of our society, but, I wonder how much of that deployment and that goodwill undercuts the, sort of some of the messages that King, by his death, was trying to promote that were broader. I mean, now it feels to me that when we look upon King's life, at least broadly speaking in American society, it is exclusively, largely, on the terms of emancipation for African Americans in this country, as opposed to much of the sort of political economic message that he had.
Well, you may recall that his last campaign, the Poor People's Campaign, which he was in the process of launching in Washington, D.C., was going to try to tie up this capital city in massive civil disobedience until Congress acted on measures involving wealth redistribution. And now wealth redistribution, to a certain extent, is the third rail to this very day of U.S. politics. You have few, even Democrats, beyond perhaps Bernie Sanders and others who call themselves socialists, who are willing to raise that issue frontally. You now have Reverend William Barber with his Poor People's Movement. He, of course, is out of North Carolina, who's trying to pick up the mantle of Dr. King. The kind of difficulty he's had in gaining traction shows and suggests that talking about wealth redistribution in this society, even in an era of pandemic, when unemployment claims are skyrocketing, when many do not have adequate medical care in the midst of this scourge known as COVID-19, looking back from today's perspective, we can begin to understand the difficulty that Martin Luther King Jr. had in trying to raise this sensitive issue just before he was assassinated on April 4th, 1968.
And can you talk about how that exact issue and his courage, I guess, to talk about these things more holistically, how that fed into the perception of him as a radical as seen by institutions in our government like the FBI, where he was seen as such an enormous threat that obviously it was infamous how J. Edgar Hoover targeted him and was obsessed with him, blackmailed him, etc.
Well, as you know, wealth redistribution is generally associated with socialism, one could say in the United States, at least for better or for worse, despite the growing legions of the poverty-stricken in our rural areas and in our urban areas. And so therefore, when you raise that issue, you are automatically, quote, tarred, unquote, with that brush of being a red or being a socialist. Now, to be fair and to be sure, Martin Luther King did express explicitly a certain pro-socialist or at least social democratic opinions and attitudes during his brief life. And I think that that infuriated the director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, who, as you know, tried to induce Martin Luther King Jr. to commit suicide. And there are still these tapes lingering in the National Archives involving the FBI taping the hotel bedrooms of Martin Luther King Jr. looking for dirt on him that would be used to discredit him. There's a new documentary out, as you probably know, MLK slash FBI, that goes into some detail about this cancerous campaign against Dr. King.
And let's talk about that, the People's March and the essentially the attempt to occupy Washington. And that was the plan, right? It wasn't simply a march, we're there, and then we go home. They really were trying to model an occupation. And what was that based upon? I mean, we had seen something similar close to 30 years earlier, I guess.
You are correct. And keep in mind as well that it not only involved Black Americans, it involved Appalachians, it involved Native Americans, it involved folks from the Southwest and Mexican Americans, the Chicano community, etc. And Mr. King, Dr. King, had already done the march August 28th, 1963, the site of his famous I Have a Dream speech. And of course, that did lead directly to change. It helped to pressure Congress with regard to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, both of which are still with us, although, as you know, the U.S. Supreme Court in 2013 in the Shelby case gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965, making it more difficult to vote. But that legacy still is present. The Poor People's Campaign of 1968 was altogether different because, once again, it was going for wealth redistribution, not just civil rights, such as being able to eat at a certain restaurant and then not necessarily having the money to pay the bill. That's where economic rights, that's where wealth redistribution enters the fray.
Increasingly, I am becoming more and more convinced that, I guess, Reconstruction was the more, I mean, you know, obviously, officially, we date the birth of this country, 100 years earlier, more or less, than Reconstruction. But Reconstruction really, in many respects, at least, with the passage of the 14th Amendment, has been, in many respects, sort of like the second pass at our Constitution. And we have been living, in many respects, with the sort of a rebirth of the nation at that time, and then almost like a stillbirth of the rebirth of the nation as Jim Crow ended up ending that era. How, within that context, was this era in which Martin Luther King Jr. Was pushing for these civil rights? I mean, do you as a historian perceive this to be another, I don't know, within that, I guess, trajectory of Reconstruction? I mean, what is the relationship between those two eras in your mind?
Well, certainly, I think there is even a historical consensus that the period of the 1960s symbolized by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. represented a kind of second Reconstruction. The Reconstruction of the 19th century, circa 1865 to 1876, 1877, was indeed a refounding, because before the U.S. Civil War, it would not be unfair to suggest that the United States was akin to a kind of contemporary European Union, where you see France and Germany under the same jurisdictional umbrella of the Brussels-based European Union, but exercising a fair amount of sovereignty on its own. After the U.S. Civil War, the United States in some ways congealed into one entity, the United States of America with rights that would apply whether you're in South Carolina or New York. But as you know, what happens is an uprising spearheaded by the Ku Klux Klan involving, interestingly enough, a kind of mob action that you witnessed a few days ago in Washington, D.C., with the overthrowing of Reconstruction governments that had black input, and then the installation of a kind of U.S. apartheid for the next 90 years up until the emergence of Dr. King, who was trying to then resuscitate, revive the spirit, if not the actuality, of the first Reconstruction, which had a promise through the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment of full civil rights. And I think that in terms of his historical role, he was able to advance that 19th century agenda into the 20th century, but unfortunately passed away or was killed before the next stage of his life and career could be actualized, speaking of wealth redistribution.
How much of, I mean, I guess to a certain extent, you know, what took place in the Capitol last week, it definitely reminded me, we've talked to many people over the past several months about things like these massacres that took place in the Reconstruction South, where you had black lawmakers and the sort of, I guess, the backlash against them, whether it's in South Carolina or North Carolina. And I wonder, like, how much of, when we see the ascendancy of the right, and we spoke last week to someone who had written a piece about the birth of the concept of, like, taxpayer rights, if you will, and how that was used by former plantation owners as a way of reasserting their political power when they found that, like, Appalachian North Country folk, this is specifically in South Carolina, were not that interested in, could not be organized around against race, you know, on the grounds of racism, but rather it was on the grounds of taxation that was being levied by black lawmakers. And when I contemplate the way that Reconstruction unraveled that time, I can't help but wonder if and how durable it was, right? I mean, we had Jim Crow then for decades following that era. If what we don't see in the form of what the right wing has done in this country since the early 70s as a backlash to that era, this most recent era of Reconstruction, that it takes the form of, we shouldn't tax, but we know what Lee Atwater said, you know, in 1954, you could say the N-word, the N-word, the N-word. And now you simply talk about busing or about taxation and you get the same, you hit all the same buttons. I wonder if we're not seeing and hopefully culminating, although I suspect not, with the Trump years, if we're not still seeing a form of a backlash to everything that came from that era of civil rights.
Well, obviously you're onto something. We see that embodied in the figure of one Ronald Wilson Reagan, who quite notoriously began his 1980 journey to the presidency with a speech in Philadelphia, Mississippi, not coincidentally the site of the 1964 slaying of civil rights workers, Cheney, Swerner, and Goodman. This invocation of the notion of states' rights tended to suggest that Washington would not interfere in the alleged internal affairs of Mississippi if it wanted to engage in a kind of de facto segregation, not like, for example, what President Eisenhower did in 1957 in Little Rock, Arkansas, when he sent federal troops into Central High School to effectuate a court order mandating a school desegregation. I think another parallel between these two eras is that in 1861, the Lincoln government was willing to compromise with the slave-owning class basically trying to get the slave-owning class to delimit the expansion of slavery, but that was not good enough for the slave-owning class. They tried to overthrow the Lincoln government and wound up losing billions of dollars in property and enslaved Africans. It is possible, underscore possible, that on January 6th, the lineal descendants of those who rose against the Capitol in 1861 may have overreached themselves, not unlike their predecessors in 1861, which could lead to imprisonment of many of their leaders, a fracturing, ironically, of the Republican Party base, ironically, because it was the Republican Party led by Lincoln that was seeking to limit slavery. And we now have this metamorphosis, this transition, where the Republican Party now is the embodiment of this doctrine of states' rights, which gives South Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama the right to do to the Negroes whatever they so choose.
Well, I would also say the Republican Party, you're absolutely right, of course, but they're also the embodiment of minority rule in the sense that they are outnumbered in the country in terms of their ideology. It's a dying ideology. And Republican senators, for example, I forget the statistic, but now that it's a 50-50 split, the Democratic senators represent around 40 million more people, I believe, than the Republican senators. So can you talk about that tension as well, how conservative ideology based on the preservation of a specific minority of the country, how that informs some of the tension that you've discussed here?
Well, you see that clearly in what should have been the biggest story thus far of 2021, speaking of the election in Georgia, where John Ossoff, a Jewish American, was elected as the first Jewish senator from Georgia in a state where about 105 years ago, Leo Frank, a business manager, a Jewish man, was lynched by ultra-right-wing Klan-like forces, and Reverend Raphael Warnock, a Black American, sitting in the same church, Ebenezer Baptist, as Dr. King and his father, was elected likewise as a senator. I don't think you can begin to understand those dual victories without understanding the demographic transformation of the state of Georgia. Not only the fact that many Black Americans were returning to the South from New York, Boston, and elsewhere, but also because of the activity of former mayor and former congressman Andrew Young, who once was UN ambassador and used those international contacts to bring in more businesses to the once sleepy capital that is Atlanta, followed by Maynard Jackson, where the airport is now named after him, another Black American. By some measures, that airport is the busiest in the world. That helps to bring in a more diverse population of Asian Americans, Latinos, Latinx population, et cetera. And so the fact that the white Americans can vote against Ossoff and Warnock, 7-3, cannot overcome or overwhelm the fact that Warnock and Ossoff win overwhelmingly by taking in 9 out of 10 Black votes. That was the edge that they got. That obviously is infuriating many, not least the president of the United States, who, as you know, has been railing against the fact that he too lost the state of Georgia on November 3rd, 2020. And so it's going to be very difficult for the Republican Party to succeed once these demographic changes that you saw in Georgia spread to places like South Carolina, Alabama, or alternatively, you can see the leadership in South Carolina and Alabama seeking to prevent economic transformation, which leads to demographic transformation, which leads to a slow extinction of the Republican Party.
I'm interested in your sense of it, because not only did they get did Ossoff and Warnock get 9 out of 10 Black votes, but the number of voters that came out was breaking records, and, particularly for a runoff, I should say, but even in the general. How much does a victory in Georgia on the essentially the backs of the African American vote. How much does that inspire the vote in a place like Alabama or South Carolina? I mean, I can't help but think that Stacey Abrams' close run for the governorship in Georgia helped spur voting participation simply because it sort of shattered the idea that our votes, speaking as a, you know, within, you know, maybe African American, particularly in rural communities, our votes aren't going to make a difference anyways. Like, how much does success and sort of achievement of political power breed a more aggressive attempt to grasp even more political power?
Well, sure. Success breeds success. And I'm glad you mentioned Stacey Abrams, because it was her that symbolized, that symbolized this mobilization of Black voters in particular. Because, as you know, the Democrats traditionally, when election time comes, they rain dollars on those who control TV networks and radio networks, the air game, so to speak, and tend to neglect the ground game. Now, there would have been an excuse for that this time. Given the pandemic, it's not easy to go door to door knocking on doors in the midst of a pandemic. It's not easy even to organize bus caravans and car caravans to the polls. It's not easy even to organize absentee ballot campaigns in the midst of the pandemic. But yet Stacey Abrams and her comrades sailed into those headwinds and was able to pull off these major victories, November 3rd and January 5th. However, once again, I'm not sure if that's a template for neighboring states in Dixie, because they do not have a similar demographic makeup to Georgia. And I'm speaking to you from the state of Texas, which has a similar demographic makeup in spades to the state of Georgia. But as you know, Mr. Trump won this state. Ted Cruz is the senator from this state. And despite grumblings and rumblings about trying to remove him from office because of his participation, at least in terms of trying to overturn the presidential ballot on January 6th, that does not look like it's going to take flight. So even a demographic transformation such as you've experienced in Georgia is no guarantee. You still need that ground game. You still need that organization on the ground.
So as we wrap up here, I mean, what from your perspective as a historian, what do you think is the most important legacy that people should be contemplating in terms of Martin Luther King Jr., both in terms of, you know, the summation of his life, but also in terms of like what people should take forward?
Well, I think people should take forward the peace agenda, the anti-war agenda of Martin Luther King Jr., because keep in mind that this turning point, this hinge moment of January 6th, in some ways turned upon the fact that over the years, this government has sent so many young men and women off to resolve political disputes in places like Afghanistan and Iraq through the barrel of a gun. And it was inevitable, it seems to me, that they would seek to take those lessons and bring them back home to try to resolve political disputes through violence. So certainly the peace agenda of Martin Luther King needs to be put forth front and center. And then there's the question, once again, of wealth redistribution. The kind of poverty that Dr. King complained about is still with us. It still needs addressing in all of its permutations, not only in terms of raising the minimum wage, but organizing unions, organizing tenant unions, stopping evictions, adequate health care. And then the agenda against white supremacy, as January 6th tended to suggest, the agenda against white supremacy needs to be escalated. That may be the toughest nut to crack of all, perhaps, believe it or not, a tougher nut to crack than wealth redistribution.
I'm curious about the the sequencing of that. If we do, you think that achieving wealth distribution would, in some measure, begin to mitigate white supremacy in at a faster rate than otherwise?
Well, you know, on the surface it would, but look, I mean, many of the people who vote for GOP senators who then say, no, you should not get a $2,000 check. Many of these people are poor. That would have been a wealth redistribution measure. But they voted for congresspersons and senators who turned their back on that agenda, and they'll probably vote for them again unless and until you can build some sort of class-based formation where these folks in Eastern Kentucky tend to see the black folk in Louisville as their class brothers and sisters. And so I'm not so sure if you can even get to wealth redistribution until you tackle aggressively and forcefully the agenda of white supremacy.
It's a fascinating dilemma. And I'm also reminded of Martin Luther King. I think the quote was something to the effect of, every bomb dropped in Vietnam explodes here in the U.S., if I'm not mistaken. Gerald Horn, author, your most recent of The Bittersweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing, professor of the Moores Professorship of History of African American Studies at University of Houston. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment to wrap things up. Okay. Now, one of the traditions that we have around here on the Majority Report is when we put out our audio podcast, we put together a compilation of different clips. But there's a lot of this stuff is,
copyrighted.
Copyrighted. Yeah. Yes. Thank you, Emma. And and of course, this program replays on the Peacock app on the Choice Network. And you can see it at 5 p.m., 10 p.m. daily. And in between, you can watch Zerlina Maxwell's show and Maddie Hassan's show. Two great shows that I know you'll enjoy. For our listeners, we will include our traditional compilation of materials that include a couple of speeches of Martin Luther King's, but also his first interview appearance on network television. It's sort of fascinating. I guess I get a real kick on the way that people, related back in the day.
Yeah.
We also have Walter Cronkite announcing his death and a clip of Nina Simone singing the song Why, just within days after his death. But what we have for you is now is a couple of clips from the NBC archives. One of NBC News announcing the assassination of Martin Luther King and then Jr. Brief words by President Lyndon Baines Johnson of that same assassination. Here are those things, and we will be back with you tomorrow.
So we suffer from a kind of poverty of the spirit, which stands in glaring contrast to our scientific and technological abundance. The problem is, my friends, that we have learned to fly the air like birds, and we have learned to swim the seas like fish, and yet we haven't learned to walk the earth like brothers and sisters. Racial injustice is still the black man's burden and the white man's shame. So wherever we live in America, we have to face the fact honestly that racial discrimination is present. So don't get complacent. Certainly we've made some strides. We've made some progress here and there. But it hadn't been enough. It hadn't been fast enough. And although we've come a long, long way, we still have a long, long way to go. In 1863, the Negro was freed from the bondage of physical slavery through the Emancipation Proclamation signed by Abraham Lincoln. But the Negro was not given any land to make that freedom meaningful. And you know, it was something like having a man in jail for years and years, and then you suddenly discover that this man is innocent. And go to him and say, now you are free. A man had been unjustly jailed for 35 or 40 years, and you just put him out of jail saying, now you are free. Don't give him any bus fare to get to town, no money to buy any clothes, no money to get something to eat. This is what happened to the black man in this country. And I can't limit my concern to the middle class. I can't limit my concern to this particular situation where a Negro comes and says, I'm the first this. I'm just tired of the first Negro. I want some seconds and some thirds and some fourths. The civil rights movement has to address itself to this, and the nation has to do it. You see, we are such a rich nation and a fluent nation, and we often don't see the poor. There are some, you see, most white people can't see the poor because they live in the suburbs, and then they get in town in these big cities on expressways. They don't know nothing about Watts. They've never been there. They don't know anything about Huff in Cleveland or the west side or the south side of Chicago or Harlem. They've never seen it. And they allow the poor to become invisible. And a lot of Negroes, you know, who have somehow sailed or floated out of the backwaters or the muddy waters, and they've kind of been able to ease out into the fresh flowing waters of the mainstream, have forgotten the stench of the backwater. And I can hear a voice saying that wasn't enough. I was hungry and you fed me not. I was naked and you clothed me not. I needed shelter and you didn't give it to me. I needed a drink of water. And in a while, that's three-fourths water, you made me pay a water bill.
The open mind, free to examine, to question, to disagree. Our subject today, the new Negro. Your host on The Open Mind is Richard D. Heffner, author and historian.
I think it's safe to say that the lot of the Negro in America has, throughout our history, deeply bothered the conscience of each and every one of us who deeply believes in traditional American principles of democracy and liberty and justice and freedom. I think this may be a little less true today than ever before. And yet, for the larger part of American history, I think we ought to realize that the Negro, more or less, was in slavery. I think the Negro was more likely to be a slave for the greater part of our history than not. And quite naturally, the attitude of the Negro towards the white, of the white towards the Negro, and of the Negro towards himself, has been conditioned and tempered and molded in very large part by the fact of a long history of slavery. Besides, I think it's important to remember that slavery as an institution put a premium not upon self-assertiveness and the understanding of one's own human dignity, but upon acquiescence by the Negro's slave. And I think that one can fairly say that the acquiescent, submissive Negro slave was generally, well, to put it very bluntly, generally safer than the self-assertive Negro who is conscious of his own human dignity and of the democratic philosophy that is the American heritage. As a matter of fact, I think we could admit that the whole myth that we have built up about the Old South, in which slavery existed, has been a myth in which we see the picture of the happy, acquiescent slave. The Negro is a slave. The Negro who is acquiescent is happy. The Negro who is happy is, by definition, acquiescent. Negroes are happy because they accept their lot. And think of the movies and the books and the plays and the novels that we read and see about slavery in the Old South. We see the Negro who is acquiescent as happy. The Negro slave who is self-assertive, looks for his own rights, is considered a troublemaker. Even when slavery was brought to an end by the Civil War, it was said that acquiescence and acceptance by the Negro of his lot, well, these were the greater part of wisdom. It was said that the Negro could gain more by submerging his own sense of dignity than by asserting it. That the Negro would so antagonize others by demanding his own rights that it was better for him to bide his time at each step along the way, wait for something to be given to him rather than demand it as of his own right. Well, men of goodwill, I think both Negro and white cannot deny that to some extent there is validity to this argument. But the degree of that extent, to what extent this is true, is the question that we must face today. In recent years, there have grown up leaders amongst both Negroes and whites who feel that a just and a wise self-assertiveness is necessary on the part of the Negro. There has been, emerging in our own times, a new Negro, a Negro who is aware of his own dignity and of the American tradition of liberty and justice. We want to talk today about that new Negro, about who he is and what he is, and our guests are quite expert in the subject. My first guest is the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. of Montgomery, Alabama. Reverend King has been very much involved in the demand by the new Negro for his rights in the Negro bus boycott in Montgomery and in many other instances. My second guest is a jurist, Judge J. Wades Waring, formerly federal judge in South Carolina, a gentleman whose decisions in the area of segregation paved the way in a very real sense for what became in 1954 the Supreme Court's decision that segregation in our public schools is unconstitutional. Well, gentlemen, suppose we begin this discussion by letting me, well, first ask you, Dr. King, in your estimation, what and who is this new Negro?
I think I could best answer that question by saying first that the new Negro is a person with a new sense of dignity and destiny, with a new self-respect. Along with that, is this like a fear which once characterized the Negro, this willingness to stand up courageously for what he feels is just and what he feels he deserves on the basis of the laws of the land. I think also included would be this self-assertive attitude that you just mentioned. And all of these factors come together to make what seems to me to be the new Negro. I think also I would like to mention this growing honesty which characterizes the Negro today. There was a time that the Negro used duplicity or deception to rather as a survival technique. Although he didn't particularly like conditions, he said he liked them because he felt that the boss wanted to hear that. But now from the housetops, from the kitchen, from the classrooms, and from the pulpits, the Negro says in no uncertain terms that he doesn't like the way he's being treated. So at long last, the Negro is telling the truth. And I think this is also one of the basic characteristics of the new Negro.
Judge Waring, does this sound like an adequate description of the Negro whom you know today?
Honest half, no, I think it's excellent. It's an excellent summary. My observation of the Negro, and I'm speaking in generalities, of course, has been that up to recently he's been a half-man or a part-man. And now at last he's waking up to the fact that he's a whole man, that he's an American citizen, and that he is entitled to rights, no more, no less, than just the ordinary run-of-the-mill American citizen. He's never had that before. He hasn't been allowed to have it. He's been under political domination. He's been under stress. He's been under economic deprivations. He's been a servant, formerly a slave. And now suddenly I see the idea has come to him that he's really, truly a man that can stand up on his own hind legs and tell the truth and say, I want not any special privilege. I don't want any special handout. I don't want to be given anything, because the giving idea is all wrong. But I want a chance to become a full man and do my part, be it little or be it big, in the community of our country.
But doesn't this raise the question of tactics, though? You say, you use the word honesty. You feel that honesty is important here, too. But as a matter of securing for the Negro his rights, do you feel that this aggressiveness, this self-assertiveness, will get him more in the long run than going along with contemporary opinion and biding his time, taking step by step as he goes?
I think it's better to be aggressive at this point. It seems to me that it is both historically and sociologically true that privileged classes do not give up their privileges voluntarily, and they do not give them up without strong resistance. And all of the gains that have been made, that we have received in the area of civil rights, have come about because the Negro stood up courageously for these rights, and he was willing to aggressively press on. So I would think that it would be much better in the long run to stand up and be aggressive with understanding goodwill and with a sense of discipline. Yet these things should not be substitutes for pressing on. And with this aggressive attitude, I believe that we will bring the gains or other civil rights into being much sooner than we would just standing idly by, waiting for these things to be given voluntarily.
What about the ill will that's generated by the aggressiveness? Certainly your own experience in Montgomery. You have been the target of bomb attacks. You've been the target of verbal and other kinds of violence. What about the ill will that is generated by aggressiveness?
Well, I think that is a necessary phase of the transition. Whenever oppressed people stand up for their rights and rise up against the oppressor, so to speak, the initial response of the oppressor is bitterness. That's true in most cases, I think. And that is what we are now experiencing in the South, is this initial response of bitterness, which I hope will be transformed into a more brotherly attitude. We hope that the end will be redemption and reconciliation rather than division. But this, it seems to me, is a necessary phase of the transition from the old order of segregation and discrimination to the new order of freedom and justice. And this should not last forever. It's just something that's natural right now, and as soon as we pass out of the shock period into the more creative period of adjustment, I think that bitterness and ill will pass away.
This sounds, in a sense, to be, if I may say this, in a sense to be a denial of the judicial process, saying we will work, the judicial process doesn't allow for the violent activity. the aggressiveness.
And it means, in a sense, stepping outside, not outside the law, but outside that slow step-by-step process that has been going on in the courts. Do you think, for instance, that the courts would have been moved to action that would have taken the place of your boycott in Montgomery had you not acted? Do you think there could be a substitute for that kind of action?
I think not. I think it was necessary to do it. I think it was the time was right. And I don't think there could have been a substitute at that particular time.
Do you think that the judicial structure can survive for that?
I want to say something on that. I think undoubtedly the action that Mr. King and his friends took in Montgomery was fine, necessary, and effective. Remember, the courts don't go out as an executive branch of the government should and do things for you. The court declares what your rights are. And the court says to you, you're an American citizen. Now, of course, if you are scared and hide in a closet and don't exercise the rights of American citizens, the court can't send around and say you've got to do it. The courts have declared the rights, and I think that the Supreme Court decision of May 17, 1954, was the greatest thing that's happened in this country in many, many decades. And I think that it declared in effect that segregation, legal segregation, segregation by law is illegal and not a part of the American system. And all the people, the big people and the little people throughout this land, have awakened to the fact that they have a right. Now remember this, it's not a matter of giving rights. Rights aren't given. The right to vote isn't given to you. It's yours, and it belongs to you. And the Negro people are beginning to realize that they are ordinary human beings and American citizens, and they have these rights. And the courts have told them so. Now, it's up to them to move out. They haven't got to go out with guns and bombs and bayonets, but they've got to go out with determination and courage and steadfastness, like this man Luther King has done, and say, here am I. And I stand here on my rights. And it's going to prevail, it's got to prevail, and it can't be beaten if we have enough of them who are steadfast enough. When they begin to compromise and sell out on principle, then they're gone. Now, it's a matter of strategy is to keep a complete, solid front. There may be tactics as to whether you want to make bus cases first or school cases or railroad cases or things of that kind. Those are minor details. But the strategy is you must never surrender any of the rights you've gained, and you must look forward to the attainment of full equality.
Well, I know that's your strategy. What about future tactics? Where do you go from here?
Well, that's pretty difficult question to answer at this point, since in Montgomery we have not worked out any future plans, that is, in any chronological order. We are certainly committed to work and press on until segregation is non-existent in Montgomery and all over the South. We are committed to full equality and doing away with injustice wherever we find it. But as to the next move, I don't have the answer for that, because we have not worked that out at this point. We, I guess, have been so involved in the bus situation until we have not had the real time to sit down and think about next move. But in a general sense, we are committed to achieving first-class citizenship in every area of life in Montgomery and throughout the southern community.
Well, to what extent, this is a question that has occurred to me, I wondered to what extent the judicial decision of May 1954 stimulated a greater feeling of self-respect amongst Negroes and intensified in them a willingness to assert their demands.
I think it had a tremendous impact and influence on the Negro and and bring about this new self-respect. I think it certainly is one of the major factors, not the only. I think several other forces and historical circumstances must be brought into the picture. The fact that circumstances made it necessary for the Negro to travel more, so that his rural plantation background was gradually supplanted by a more urban industrial life. Illiteracy was gradually passing away, and with the growth of the cultural life of the Negro, that brought about new self-respect and economic growth, and also the tremendous impact of the world situation, with people all over the world seeking freedom from colonial powers and imperialism. These things all came together, and then with the decision of May 17, 1954, we gained the culminating point. That, it seems to me, was the final point which came and to bring all of these things together, and that gave this new Negro a new self-respect, which we see all over the South and all over the nation today.
Well, if this was a final point, in a sense, a culminating point, why do you ask now for another act on a national level, an act, let's say, on the part of the president for a speech in the South? Why is this so important? Haven't enough steps been made up to this point to enable you to carry the ball from here on?
Well, I think it's necessary for all of the forces possible to be working to implement and enforce the decisions that are handed down by the courts. And so often in the area of civil rights, it seems that the judicial branch of the government is fighting the battle alone. And we feel that the executive and legislative branches of the government have a basic responsibility. And at points, these branches have been all too silent and all too stagnant in their moves to implement and enforce the decisions. With the popularity of the president and his tremendous power and influence, just a word from him could do a great deal to ease the situation, calm emotions, and give Southern white liberals something to stand on, if it is nothing but something to quote. The Southern white liberal stands in a pretty difficult position because he does not have anywhere to turn for emotional security, similar to what hate groups, I mean the things that other groups have to turn to, the hate organizations, so to speak. But with a word from the President of the United States, with his power and influence, it would give a little more courage and backbone to the white liberals in the South who are willing to be allies in the struggle with the Negro for first-class citizenship.
Now, to what extent, let me ask you this question, Judge Waring, are white Southerners willing to be allies in the battle of the new Negro?
That's a very hard question to answer. There are very, very few that are willing to come out in the open and say so. There are a great many, in my opinion, who would be glad if they are made to do it. I think that there are lots of people. I sometimes use the expression that the little boy with a dirty face won't go and wash it, but if you grab him by the neck and scrub his face, he then boasts he's got the cleanest face in the gang. And I think there are many of the people in the South, and I saw many of them. My experience was that officially I was quite hated and condemned because I had expressed my views to what I thought the laws of the land were. And I got a lot of telephone messages and anonymous letters saying they agreed with me, but they couldn't tell me why or how or who they were. And those people want to be freed. But the overall picture of the politicians, no politician in the South is going to dare come out and take this position of his own volition. But if the President of the United States tells him so, he's going to fall in line. And if we can get the top executive people to take action, we'll get somewhere. Remember this now. The Supreme Court has laid down the law and said what's constitutional. Now, that's important. That's most important. It's the biggest thing that's ever happened. But it's got to be activated. It's got to be worked out, and the executive department has got to manipulate and work it and enforce it. And the legislative department should give the executive department more power to work and enforce these laws.
You feel that action, then you do too, feel that action has to be taken on this level.
Oh, yes, very definitely.
Let me ask again, though, about the feelings of the Southern whites. How do you evaluate? If you had to give a progress report, how would you evaluate the battle you've fought over this past year? In terms of Southern feelings, in terms of Northern white feelings, too.
Well, I think we have seen, we've been able to see mixed emotions at this point. For instance, over from a national point of view, looking all over the nation, we have had tremendous response and real genuine sympathy from many, many white persons, and naturally we've had the sympathy of Negroes, but many, many white persons of goodwill all over the nation have given moral support and a great deal of encouragement, and that has been very encouraging to us in the struggle. Now, in the South, I guess the lines are more closely drawn. You find, on the one hand, a group more determined now than ever before, because it is a last-ditch struggle to do anything, even if it means using violence, to block all of the intentions and the desires of the Negro to achieve first-class citizenship. But there are also others who have expressed sympathy. There are white Southerners, even in Montgomery, who have been quite sympathetic. As Judge Warren just said, sometimes these people, because of fear, refuse to say anything about it. They stand back because of fear of economic, social, and political reprisals. But there is a silent sympathy. We have seen a great deal of that in Montgomery. So that it's two sides. There's this side where you get the negative response, the other side where you have the positive response, and I have seen both. And I think as time goes on, the negative side will get smaller and smaller, and those who are willing to be open-minded and accept the trends of the ages will grow into a majority group rather than a minority.
You don't feel that there'll be any violent reaction then over a long-range point of view to the progress that has been made?
No, I don't. I think the violence will be temporary. Maybe, I don't say it will end tomorrow. We will go through some more for the next few months. But I think once we are over the shock period, that shock will be absorbed, and Southerners will come to the point of seeing that the best thing to do is to sit down and work out these problems and do it in a very Christian spirit. I think the violence that we are undergoing now is indicative of the fact that the diehards realize that they are on their standing at the dying point. That is, the system is at its dying point, and that this is a last way to try to hold on to the old order.
Mr. Hefner, all great reforms have periods of trouble. Gandhi was murdered. Jesus was crucified. And you find that most great reforms have certain periods of stress and distress. Now, just one last point I want to make. When we speak of the law, it's terribly important that we bring these cases and have a declaration of law, an action by Congress, an action by the executive. Because now, or up to the time of the Supreme Court's decision, segregation was legal. And segregation, even people of goodwill in the South said, but the law says we have to keep these people separate. For instance, it has been illegal for me to ride in a bus with Mr. King here. Now, I don't want a law that says I've got to ride with him or he's got to ride with me, but I don't want a law that says I can't sit in a seat with him. And we've broken that, and that's an enormous advance. And we've got to do it on every stage right down the line. The Congress of the United States, I believe, I've been very cynical and skeptical about it, but I'm beginning to believe they're going to do a little something this time. And if they do a little something, they haven't done anything in 75 years. If they do a little something this time, they'll do a little more next year. And the President of the United States and the officials in the administration will begin to see that if Congress is moving, it's good politics to move, and that'll have a great motivating product on the national picture. I think we are going forward. We are going forward inexorably. We've got to win. Now, it's a question whether we're going to win the short term or a long term. For the short term.
How do you project this into the immediate future?
Well, when I think of the question of progress in the area of race relations, I prefer to be realistic. And when I say that, I mean I try to look at it from the pessimistic point of view or the optimistic, but rather from the realistic point of view. I think we've come a long, long way, but we have a long, long way to go. But it seems to me that if we would press on with determination, moral courage, and yet wise restraint and calm reasonableness, in a few years we will reach the goal. I have a great deal of faith in the future and the outcome. I am not despairing.
And I'm sure as long as we have men like you, we can all have faith. Thank you so much, Reverend King, Judge Waring. Next week we'll give a summary report of civil rights over the past year. Gentlemen, I think that went very, very nicely.
We all
very
good. WRCA has just presented The Open Mind.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I need not pause to say how very delighted I am to be here tonight. And how very delighted I am to see you expressing your concern about the issues that will be discussed tonight by turning out in such large numbers. I also want to say that I consider it a great honor to share this program with Dr. Bennett, Dr. Cominger, and Rabbi Heschel, some of the distinguished leaders and personalities of our nation. And of course, it's always good to come back to Riverside Church. Over the last 8 years, I have had the privilege of preaching here almost every year in that period. It is always a rich and rewarding experience to come to this great church and this great pulpit. I come to this magnificent house of worship tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. I join you in this meeting because I am in deepest agreement with the aims and work of the organization which has brought us together, clergy and laymen concerned about Vietnam. The recent statements of your executive committee are the sentiments of my own heart, and I found myself in full accord when I read its opening lines. A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam. The truth of these words is beyond doubt. But the mission to which they call us is a most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. Moreover, when the issues at hand seem as perplexing as they often do, in the case of this dreadful conflict, we are always on the verge of being mesmerized by uncertainty. But we must move on. Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. But we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision. But we must speak. And we must rejoice as well, for surely this is the first time in our nation's history that a significant number of its religious leaders have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of a firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. Perhaps a new spirit is rising among us. If it is, let us trace its movements and pray that our own inner being may be sensitive to its guidance. For we are deeply in need of a new way beyond the darkness that seems so close around. Over the past 2 years, as I have moved to break the betrayal of my own silences and to speak from the burnings of my own heart, as I have called for radical departures from the destruction of Vietnam, many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. At the heart of their concerns, this query has often loomed large and loud. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. Aren't you hurting the cause of your people, they ask. And when I hear them, though I often understand the source of their concern, I am nevertheless greatly saddened, for such questions mean that the inquirers have not really known me, my commitment or my calling. Indeed, their questions suggest that they do not know the world in which they live. In the light of such tragic misunderstanding, I deem it of signal importance to try to state clearly, and I trust concisely, why I believe that the path from Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, the church in Montgomery, Alabama, where I began my pastorate, leads clearly to this sanctuary tonight. I come to this platform tonight to make a passionate plea to my beloved nation. This speech is not addressed to Hanoi or to the National Liberation Front. It is not addressed to China or to Russia. Nor is it an attempt to overlook the ambiguity of the total situation and the need for a collective solution to the tragedy of Vietnam. Neither is it an attempt to make North Vietnam or the National Liberation Front paragons of virtue, not to overlook the role they must play in the successful resolution of the problem. While they both may have justifiable reasons to be suspicious of the good faith of the United States, life and history give eloquent testimony to the fact that conflicts are never resolved without trustful give and take on both sides. Tonight, however, I wish not to speak with Hanoi and the National Liberation Front, but rather to my fellow Americans. Since I am a preacher by calling, I suppose it is not surprising that I have seven major reasons for bringing Vietnam into the field of my moral vision. That is, at the outset, a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. And then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched this program broken and eviscerated, as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor, so long as adventures like Vietnam continue to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such. Perhaps a more tragic recognition of reality took place, and it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Holland. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. So we watched them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village. But we realized that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago. I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. My third reason moves to an even deeper level of awareness, for it grows out of my experience in the ghettos of the North over the last 3 years, especially the last three summers. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our home nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed and the ghetto without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent. For those who ask the question, are you a civil rights leader? And thereby mean to exclude me from the movement for peace, I have this further answer. In 1957, when a group of us formed the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, we chose as our motto to save the soul of America. We were convinced that we could not limit our vision to certain rights for black people, but instead affirmed the conviction that America would never be free or saved from itself until the descendants of its slaves were loosed completely from the shackles they still wear. In a way, we were agreeing with Langston Hughes, that black barber column, who had written earlier, "Oh yes, I say it plainly, America never was America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be." Now it should be incandescently clear that no one who has any concern for the integrity and life of America today can ignore the present war. If America's soul becomes totally poisoned, part of the autopsy must read Vietnam. It can never be saved so long as it destroys the deepest hopes of men the world over. So it is that those of us who are yet determined that America will be are led down the path of protest and dissent, working for the health of our land. As if the weight of such a commitment to the life and health of America were not enough, another burden of responsibility was placed upon me in 1954, and I cannot forget that the Nobel Peace Prize was also a commission to work harder than I had ever worked before for the brotherhood of man. This is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances. But even if it were not present, I would yet have to live with the meaning of my commitment to the ministry of Jesus Christ. To me, the relationship of this ministry to the making of peace is so obvious that I sometimes marvel at those who ask me why I'm speaking against it. Could it be that they do not know that the good news was meant for all men, for communists and capitalists, for their children and ours, for black and for white, for revolutionary and conservative? And they have forgotten that my ministry is in obedience to the one who loved his enemies so fully that he died for them. What then can I say to the Viet Cong, or to Castro, or to Mao, as a faithful minister of this one? Can I threaten them with death, or must I not share with them my life? Finally, as I try to explain to you and for myself the road that leads from Montgomery to this place, I would have offered all that was most valid if I simply said that I must be true to my conviction, that I share with all men the calling to be a son of the living God. Beyond the calling of race, a nation, a creed, is this vocation of sonship and brotherhood. Because I believe that the Father is deeply concerned, especially for his suffering and helpless and outcast children, I come tonight to speak for them. This I believe to be the privilege and the burden of all of us who deem ourselves bound by allegiances and loyalties, which are broader and deeper than nationalism, and which go beyond our nation's self-defined goals and positions. We are called to speak for the weak, for the voiceless, for the victims of our nation, for those it calls enemy. For no document from human hands can make these humans any less our brothers. And as I ponder the madness of Vietnam, and search within myself for ways to understand and respond in compassion, my mind goes constantly to the people of that peninsula. I speak now not of the soldiers of each side, not of the ideologies of the Liberation Front, not of the hunter inside gone, but simply of the people who have been living under the curse of war for almost three continuous decades now. I think of them too, because it is clear to me that there will be no meaningful solution there until some attempt is made to know them and hear their broken cries. They must see Americans as strange liberators. Vietnamese people proclaimed their own independence in 1954. In 1945, after a combined French and Japanese occupation, and before the Communist Revolution in China, they were led by Ho Chi Minh. Even though they quoted the American Declaration of Independence in their own document of freedom, we refused to recognize them. Instead, we decided to support France in its reconquest of a former colony. Our government felt then that the Vietnamese people were not ready for independence. We again fell victim to the deadly Western arrogance that has poisoned the international atmosphere for so long. With that tragic decision, we rejected a revolutionary government seeking self-determination, and a government that had been established not by China, for whom the Vietnamese have no great love, but by clearly indigenous forces that included some communists. For the peasants, this new government meant real land reform, one of the most important needs in their lives. For 9 years following 1945, we denied the people of Vietnam the right of independence. For 9 years, we vigorously supported the French in their abortive effort to recolonize Vietnam. Before the end of the war, we were meeting 80% of the French war cost. Even before the French were defeated at Dien Bien Phu, they began to despair of their reckless action, but we did not. We encouraged them with our huge financial and military supplies to continue the war even after they had lost. Soon we would be paying almost the full cost of this tragic attempt at recolonization. After the French were defeated, it looked as if independence and land reform would come again through the Geneva Agreement. Then instead there came the United States, determined that whole should not unify the temporarily divided nation. And the peasants watched again as we supported one of the most vicious modern dictators, our chosen man, Premier Diem. The peasants watched and cringed as Diem ruthlessly rooted out all opposition, supported their extortionist landlords, and refused even to discuss reunification with the North. Peasants watched as all of this was presided over by United States influence, and then by increasing numbers of United States troops who came to help quell the insurgency that Diem's methods had aroused. When Diem was overthrown, they may have been happy, but the long line of military dictators seemed to offer no real change, especially in terms of their need for land and peace. The only change came from America, as we increased our troop commitments in support of governments which were singularly corrupt, inept, and without popular support. All the while, the people read our leaflets and received irregular promises of peace and democracy and land reform. Now they languish under our bombs and consider us not their fellow Vietnamese, the real enemy. They move sadly and apathetically as we herd them off the land of their fathers into concentration camps where minimal social needs are rarely met. They know they must move on or be destroyed by our bombs. So they go, primarily women and children and babies. They watch as we poison their water, as we kill 1 million acres of their crops. They must weep as the bulldozers roar through their areas, preparing to destroy the precious trees. They wandered into the hospitals,
with at least 20 casualties from American firepower for one Viet Cong inflicted injury. So far, we may have killed a million of them, mostly children. They wander into the towns and see thousands of the children, homeless, without clothes, running in packs on the streets like animals. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. They see the children selling their sisters to our soldiers, soliciting for their mothers. What do the peasants think if we ally ourselves with the landlords? And as we refuse to put any action into our many words concerning land reform, what do they think if we test out our latest weapons on them, just as the Germans tested out new medicine and new tortures in the concentration camps of Europe, where are the roots of the independent Vietnam we claim to be building? Is it among these voiceless ones? We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village. We have destroyed their land and their crops. We have cooperated in the crushing of the nation's only non-communist revolutionary political force, the Unified Buddhist Church. We have supported the enemies of the peasants of Saigon. We have corrupted their women and children and killed their men. Now that is little left to build on save bitterness. Soon the only solid physical foundations remaining will be found at our military bases and in the concrete of the concentration camps we call fortified hamlets. Peasants may well wonder if we plan to build our new Vietnam on such grounds as these. But we blame them for such thoughts. We must speak for them and raise the questions they cannot raise. These two are brothers. Perhaps a more difficult but no less necessary task is to speak for those who have been designated as our enemies. What of the National Liberation Front? That strangely anonymous group we call VC of Communists. What must they think of the United States of America? And they realize that we permitted the repression and cruelty of Diem, which helped to bring them into being as a resistance group in the South. What do they think of our condoning the violence which led to their own taking up of arms? How can they believe in our integrity when now we speak of aggression from the North as if there were nothing more essential to the war? How can they trust us when now we charge them with violence after the murderous reign of Diem? Charge them with violence while we pour every new weapon of death into their land. Surely we must understand their feelings, even if we do not condone their actions. Surely we must see that the men we supported pressed them to their violence. Surely we must see that our own computerized plans of destruction simply dwarf their greatest acts. How do they judge us when our officials know that their membership is less than 25% communist and yet insist on giving them the blanket name? What must they be thinking when they know that we are aware of their control of major sections of Vietnam and yet we appear ready to allow national elections in which this highly organized political parallel government will not have a part? They ask how we can speak of free elections when the Saigon press is censored and controlled by the military hunter. And they're surely right to wonder what kind of new government we plan to help form without them. The only party in real touch with the peasants. They question our political goals and they deny the reality of a peace settlement from which they will be excluded. Their questions are frighteningly relevant. Is our nation planning to build on political myth again, then show it up from the power of new violence?
Here is the true meaning and value of compassion and nonviolence, when it helps us to see the enemy's point of view, to hear his questions, to know his assessment of ourselves. Far from his view, we may indeed see the basic weaknesses of our own condition. And if we are mature, we may learn and grow and profit from the wisdom of the brothers who are called the opposition. So too with Hanoi. In the north, where our bombs now pummel the land, and our minds endanger the waterways, we are met by deep but understandable mistrust. To speak for them is to explain this lack of confidence in Western words, and especially their distrust of American intentions now. In Hanoi are the men who led the nation to independence against the Japanese and the French, the men who sought membership in the French Commonwealth and were betrayed by the weakness of Paris and the willfulness of the colonial armies. It was they who led a second struggle against French domination at tremendous cost, and then were persuaded to give up the land they controlled between the 13th and 17th parallel as a temporary measure at Geneva. After 1954, they watched us conspire with Diem to prevent elections which could have surely brought Ho Chi Minh to power over a united Vietnam. They realized they had been betrayed again. And we ask why they do not leap to negotiate. These things must be remembered. Also, it must be clear that the leaders of Hanoi considered the presence of American troops in support of the Diem regime to have been the initial military breach of the Geneva Agreement concerning foreign troops. And they remind us that they did not begin to send troops in large numbers and even supplies into the South until American forces had moved into the tens of thousands. Hanoi remembers how our leaders refused to tell us the truth about the earlier North Vietnamese overtures for peace, how the president claimed that none existed when they had clearly been made. Ho Chi Minh has watched as America has spoken of peace and built up its forces. And now he has surely heard the increasing international rumors of American plans for an invasion of the North. He knows the bombing and shelling and mining we are doing a part of traditional pre-invasion strategy. Perhaps only his sense of humor and of irony can save him when he hears the most powerful nation of the world speaking of aggression as it drops thousands of bombs on a poor, weak nation more than 8,000 miles away from its shores. At this point, I should make it clear that while I have tried in these last few minutes to give a voice to the voiceless in Vietnam, to understand the arguments of those who are called enemy, I am as deeply concerned about our own troops there as anything else. For it occurs to me that what we are submitting them to in Vietnam is not simply the brutalizing process that goes on in any war where armies face each other and seek to destroy. We are adding cynicism to the process of death, for they must know after the short period there that none of the things we claim to be fighting for really involve. Before long, they must know that their government has sent them into a struggle among Vietnamese. And the more sophisticated surely realize that we are on the side of the wealthy and the secure while we create a hell for the poor. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home, death and corruption in Vietnam.
I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as one who loves America, to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours. This is a message of the great Buddhist leaders of Vietnam. Recently, one of them wrote these words, and I quote, "Each day the war goes on, the hatred increases in the heart of the Vietnamese, in the hearts of those of humanitarian instinct. The Americans are forcing even their friends into becoming their enemies. It is curious that the Americans, who calculate so carefully on the possibilities of military victory, do not realize that in the process they incur incurring deep psychological and political defeat. The image of America will never again be the image of revolution, freedom, and democracy, but the image of violence and militarism," unquote. We continue, "There will be no doubt in my mind and in the mind of the world that we have no honorable intentions in Vietnam. We do not stop our war against the people of Vietnam immediately. The world would be left with no other alternative than to see this as some horrible, clumsy, and deadly game we have decided to play. The world now demands a maturity of America that we may not be able to achieve. It demands that we admit that we have been wrong from the beginning of our adventure in Vietnam, that we have been detrimental to the life of the Vietnamese people. The situation is one in which we must be ready to turn sharply from our present ways. In order to atone for our sins and errors in Vietnam, we should take the initiative in bringing a halt to this tragic war. I would like to suggest five concrete things that our government should do to begin the long and difficult process of extricating ourselves from this nightmarish conflict. Number one, end all bombing in North and South Vietnam. Number two, declare a unilateral ceasefire in the hope that such action will create the atmosphere for negotiation. Three, take immediate steps to prevent other battlegrounds in Southeast Asia by curtailing our military buildup in Thailand and our interference in Laos. Four, realistically accept the fact that the National Liberation Front has substantial support in South Vietnam and must thereby play a role in any meaningful negotiations and any future Vietnam government. Five, set a date that we will remove all foreign troops from Vietnam in accordance with the 1954 Geneva Agreement. Part of our ongoing... commitment might well express itself in an offer to grant asylum to any Vietnamese who fears for his life under the new regime, which included the Liberation Front. Then we must make what reparations we can for the damage we have done. We must provide the medical aid that is badly needed, making it available in this country if necessary. Meanwhile... Meanwhile, we in the churches and synagogues have a continuing task while we urge our government to disengage itself from a disgraceful commitment. We must continue to raise our voices and our lives if our nation persists in its perverse ways in Vietnam. We must be prepared to match actions with words by seeking out every creative method of protest possible. As we counsel young men concerning military service, we must clarify for them our nation's role in Vietnam and challenge them with the alternative of conscientious objection.
say that this is a path now chosen by more than 70 students at my own alma mater, Morehouse College, and I recommend it to all who find the American course in Vietnam a dishonorable and unjust one. I would encourage all ministers of draft age to give up their ministerial exemptions and seek status as conscientious objectors. These are the times for real choices and not false ones. We are at the moment when our lives must be placed on the line if our nation is to survive its own folly. Every man of humane convictions must decide on the protest that best suits his convictions. But we must all protest. Now that is something seductively tempting about stopping there and sending us all off on what in some circles has become a popular crusade against the war in Vietnam. I say we must enter that struggle, but I wish to go on now to say something even more disturbing. The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit. And if we ignore this sobering reality, we will find ourselves organizing clergy and layman concern committees for the next generation. They will be concerned about Guatemala and Peru. They will be concerned about Thailand and Cambodia. They will be concerned about Mozambique and South Africa. We will be marching for these and a dozen other names and attending rallies without end, unless that is a significant and profound change in American life and policy. Such thoughts take us beyond Vietnam, but not beyond our calling as sons of the living God. In 1957, a sensitive American official overseas said that it seemed to him that our nation was on the wrong side of a world revolution. During the past 10 years, we have seen emerge a pattern of suppression, which has now justified the presence of U.S. military advisors in Venezuela. This need to maintain social stability for our investment accounts for the counter-revolutionary action of American forces in Guatemala. It tells why American helicopters are being used against guerrillas in Cambodia, why American napalm and green beret forces have already been active against rebels in Peru. It is with such activity in mind that the words of the late John F. Kennedy come back to haunt us. 5 years ago, he said, "Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable." Increasingly, by choice or by accident, this is the role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolution impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that come from the immense profits of overseas investments. I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. On the one hand, we are called to play the Good Samaritan on life's roadside. That will be only an initial act. One day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be transformed so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. Revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out, no concern for the social betterment of the countries, and say, this is not just. It will look at our alignment with the landed gentry of South America and say, this is not just. Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hand on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of people's normal, sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. And most powerful nation in the world can well lead the way in this revolution of values. That is nothing except a tragic death wish to prevent us from reordering our priorities so that the pursuit of peace will take precedence over the pursuit of war. There is nothing to keep us from molding a recalcitrant status quo with bruised hands until we have fashioned it into a brotherhood. This kind of positive revolution of values is our best defense against communism. War is not the answer. Communism will never be defeated by the use of atomic bombs or nuclear weapons. Let us not join those who shout war and through their misguided passions urge the United States to relinquish its participation in the United Nations. These are days which demand wise restraint and calm reasonableness. We must not engage in a negative anti-communism, but rather in a positive thrust for democracy. Realizing that our greatest defense against communism is to take offensive action in behalf of justice, we must, with positive action, seek to remove those conditions of poverty, insecurity, and injustice, which are the fertile soil in which the seed of communism grows and develops. These are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. And out of the wombs of a frail world, new systems of justice and equality are being born. shirtless and barefoot people of the land arising up as never before. People who set in darkness have seen a great light. We in the West must support these revolutions. It is a sad fact that because of comfort, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, and our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. This has driven many to feel that only Marxism has a revolutionary spirit. Therefore, communism is a judgment against our failure to make democracy real and follow through on the revolutions that we initiated. Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring eternal hostility to poverty, racism, and militarism. This powerful commitment, we shall boldly challenge the status quo and unjust mores, and thereby speed the day when every valley shall be exalted and every mountain and hill shall be made low.
Yes.
Crooked shall be made straight and the rough places plain. Genuine revolution of values means, in the final analysis, that our loyalties must become ecumenical rather than sectional. Every nation must now develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole in order to preserve the best in their individual societies. This call for a worldwide fellowship that lifts neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation is in reality a call for an all-embracing, embracing an unconditional love for all mankind. This oft misinterpreted concept, so readily dismissed by the Nietzsches of the world as a weak and cowardly, has now become an absolute necessity for the survival of man. When I speak of love, I'm not speaking of some sentimental and weak response. I'm not speaking of that force which is just emotional bosh. I'm speaking of that force which all of the great religions have seen as the supreme unifying principle of life. Love is somehow the key that unlocks the door which leads to ultimate reality. This Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist belief about ultimate reality is beautifully summed up in the first epistle of St. John. Let us love one another.
Yes.
For love is God.
Yes.
And everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. He that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love.
Yes.
If we love one another, God dwelleth in us, and his love is perfected in us. Let us hope that this spirit will become the order of the day. We can no longer afford to worship the God of hate, bow before the altar of retaliation. The oceans of history are made turbulent by the ever-rising tides of hate. History is cluttered with the records of nations and individuals that pursued this self-defeating path of hate. As Arnold Toynbee says, love is the ultimate force that makes for the saving choice of life and good against the damning choice of death and evil. Therefore, the first hope in our inventory must be the hope that love is going to have the last word, unquote. We are now faced with the fact, my friends, that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, that is such a thing as being too late. Procrastination is still the thief of time. Life often leaves us standing bare, naked, and dejected with a lost opportunity. The tide in the affairs of men does not remain at flood, it ebbs. We may cry out desperately for time to pause in her passage, but time is adamant to every plea and rushes on. over the bleached bones and jumbled residues of numerous civilizations, written the pathetic words too late. That is an invisible book of life that faithfully records our vigilance or our neglect. Omar Khayyam's right to move and finger rights and having writ moves on. We still have a choice today. Nonviolent coexistence, a violent co-annihilation. We must move past indecision to action. We must find new ways to speak for peace in Vietnam and justice throughout the developing world, a world that borders on our doors. We do not act. We shall surely be dragged down the long, dark, and shameful corridors of time, reserved for those who possess power without compassion, might without morality, and strength without sight. Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world. This is the calling of the sons of God, and our brothers wait eagerly for our response. Shall we say the odds are too great? Shall we tell them the struggle is too hard? Will our message be that the forces of American life militate against their arrival as poor men, and we send our deepest regrets? Will there be another message of longing, of hope, of solidarity with their yearnings, of commitment to their cause, whatever the cost? The choice is ours. And though we might prefer it otherwise, we must choose in this crucial moment of human history. As that noble bard of yesterday, James Russell Lowell, eloquently stated, once to every man and nation comes a moment to decide in the strife of truth and falsehood for the good or evil side. Some great cause, God's new Messiah, offering each the gloom of light, and the choice goes by forever twixt that darkness. Though the cause of evil prosper, yet this truth alone is strong. Though her portion be the scaffold, and upon the throne be wrong, yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. And if we will only make the right choice, we will be able to transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of peace. We will make the right choice. We will be able to transform the jangling discords of our world into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. If we will but make the right choice, we will be able to speed up the day all over America and all over the world when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
I need not pause to say how very delighted I am to be here this morning and to have the opportunity of standing in this very great and significant pulpit. It is always a rich and rewarding experience to take a brief break from our day-to-day demands in the struggle for freedom and human dignity, and discuss the issues involved in that struggle with concerned friends of goodwill all over our nation. And certainly it is always a deep and meaningful experience to be in a worship service. And so for many reasons, I'm happy to be here today. I would like to use as a subject from which to preach this morning, remaining awake through a great revolution. And the text for The morning is found in the book of Revelation. There are two passages there that I would like to quote. It's in the 16th chapter of that book. Behold, I make all things new. Former things are passed away. I'm sure that most of you have read that arresting little story from the pen of Washington Irving entitled Rip Van Winkle. The one thing that we usually remember about the story is that Rip Van Winkle slept 20 years. But that is another point in that little story that is almost always completely overlooked. It was a sign in the end from which Rip went up in the mountain for his long sleep. When Rip Van Winkle went up in the mountain, the sign had a picture of King George III of England. When he came down 20 years later, the sign had a picture of George Washington, the first president of the United States. And Rip Van Winkle looked up at the picture of George Washington, but in looking at the picture, he was amazed. He was completely lost. He knew not who he was. And this reveals to us that the most striking thing about the story of Rip Van Winkle is not merely that Rip slept 20 years, but that he slept through a revolution. While he was peacefully snoring up in the mountain, a revolution was taking place that at points would change the course of history. And Rip knew nothing about it. He was asleep. Yes, he slept through a revolution. One of the great liabilities of life is that all too many people find themselves living amid a great period of social change, and yet they fail to develop the new attitudes, the new mental responses that the new situation demands, and they end up sleeping through a revolution. Now, there can be no gainsaying of the fact that the great revolution has taken place in the world today, in the sense it is a triple revolution. That is a technological revolution with the impact of automation and cybernation. Then that is a revolution in weaponry with the emergence of atomic and nuclear weapons of warfare. Then that is a human rights revolution with the freedom explosion that has taken place all over the world. Yes, we do live in a period where changes are taking place, and that is still the voice crying through the vista of time, saying, behold, I make all things new. Former things are passed away. Now, whenever anything new comes into history, it brings with it new challenges and new opportunities. And I would like to deal with the challenges that we face today as a result of this triple revolution that has taken place in the world today. First, we are challenged to develop a world perspective. No individual can live alone. No nation can live alone. And anyone who feels that he can live alone is sleeping through a revolution. The world in which we live is geographically one. The challenge that we face today is to make it one in terms of brotherhood. Now, it's true that the geographical oneness of this age has come to be to a large extent through modern man's scientific ingenuity. Modern man, through his scientific genius, has been able to dwarf distance and place time in chains. And our jet planes have compressed into minutes distances that once took weeks and even months. All of this tells us that our world is a neighborhood. Through our scientific and technological genius, we have made of this world a neighborhood, and yet we have not had the ethical commitment to make of it a brotherhood. But somehow and in some way, we've got to do this. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools. We are tied together in the single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. And whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. And for some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the way God's universe is made. This is the way it is structured. John Donne caught it years ago and placed it in graphic terms. No man is an island in time itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. And he goes on toward the end to say, any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never sin to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. We must see this and believe this and live by it. If we are to remain awake through a great revolution. Secondly, we are challenged to eradicate the last vestiges of racial injustice from our nation. I must say this morning that racial injustice is still the black man's burden and the white man's shame. It is an unhappy truth that racism is a way of life for the vast majority of white Americans, spoken and unspoken, acknowledged and denied, subtle and sometimes not so subtle. The disease of racism permeates and poisons a whole body politic. And I can see nothing more urgent than for America to work passionately and unrelentingly to get rid of the disease of racism. Something positive must be done. Everyone must share in the guilt, as individuals and as institutions. And the government must certainly share the guilt. Individuals must share the guilt. Even the church must share the guilt. We must face the sad fact At 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, when we stand to sing, "In Christ there is no East nor West," we stand in the most segregated hour of America. The hour has come for everybody and for all institutions, for the public sector and the private sector, to work to get rid of racism. Now, if we are to do it, we must honestly admit certain things and get rid of certain myths that have constantly been disseminated all over our nation. One is the myth of time. It is the notion that only time can solve the problem of racial injustice. And there are those who often sincerely say to the Negro and his allies in the white community, "Why don't you slow up? Stop pushing things so fast. Only time can solve the problem. And if you will just be nice and patient and continue to pray, in 100 or 200 years, the problem will work itself out." Well, that is an answer to that myth. And it is that time is neutral. It can be used either constructively or destructively. And I'm sorry to say this morning that I'm absolutely convinced that the forces of ill will in our nation, the extreme rightists of our nation, the people on the wrong side, have used time much more effectively than the forces of goodwill. And it may well be that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and the violent actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people who sit around and say, "Wait on time." Somewhere we must come to see that human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. So we must help time and realize that the time is always right to do right. Now, that is another myth that still gets around. It is a kind of over-reliance on the bootstrap philosophy. And there are those who still feel that if the Negro is to rise out of poverty, if the Negro is to rise out of slum conditions, if he is to rise out of discrimination and segregation, he must do it all by himself. And so they say the Negro must lift himself by his own bootstraps. They never stop to realize that no other ethnic group has been a slave on American soil. The people who say this never stop to realize that the nation made the black man's color a stigma. But beyond this, they never stop to realize the debt that they owe a people who were kept in slavery 244 years. In 1863, the Negro was told that he was free as a result of the Emancipation Proclamation being signed by Abraham Lincoln. But he was not given any land to make that freedom meaningful. It was something like keeping a person in prison for a number of years and suddenly discovering that that person is not guilty of the crime for which he was convicted. And you just go up to him and say, "Now you are free." But you don't give him any bus fare to get to town. You don't give him any money to get some clothes to put on his back or to get on his feet again in life. Every code of jurisprudence would rise up against this. And yet this is the very thing that our nation did to the black man. It simply said, you're free. And it left them there penniless, illiterate, not knowing what to do. And the irony of it all is that at the same time that the nation failed to do anything for the black man, through an act of Congress, it was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did it give the land, it built land grant colleges to teach them how to farm. Not only that, it provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, as the years unfolded, it provided low interest rates so that they could mechanize our farms. And to this day, thousands of these very persons are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies every year not to farm. And these are so often the very people who tell Negroes that they must lift themselves by their own bootstraps. It's all right to tell a man to lift himself by his own bootstraps, but it is a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. We must come to see that the roots of racism are very deep in our country. And there must be something positive and massive in order to get rid of all of the effects of racism and the tragedies of racial injustice. Now, that is another thing closely related to racism that I would like to mention as another challenge. We are challenged to rid our nation and the world of poverty. Like a monstrous octopus, poverty spreads its nagging, prehensile tentacles into hamlets and villages all over our world. 2/3 of the peoples of the world go to bed hungry tonight. They are ill-housed, they are ill-nourished, they are shabbily clad. I've seen it in Latin America, I've seen it in Africa. I've seen this poverty in Asia. I remember some years ago, Mrs. King and I journeyed to that great country known as India. And I never will forget the experience. It was a marvelous experience to meet and talk with the great leaders of India. To meet and talk with and speak to thousands and thousands of people all over that vast country. And these experiences will remain dear to me as long as the cords of memory shall lengthen. But I say to you this morning, my friends, there were those depressing moments. How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes evidences of millions of people going to bed hungry at night? How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes God's children sleeping on the sidewalks at night? In Bombay, more than 1 million people sleep on the sidewalks every night. In Calcutta, more than 600,000 sleep on the sidewalks every night. They have no beds to sleep in. They have no houses to go in. How can one avoid being depressed when he discovers that out of India's population of more than 500 million people, some 480 million make an annual income of less than $90 a year, and most of them have never seen a doctor or a dentist? As I noticed these things, something within me cried out, Can we in America stand idly by and not be concerned? And an answer came, oh no. Because the destiny of the United States is tied up with the destiny of India and every other nation. And I started thinking of the fact that we spend in America millions of dollars a day to store surplus food. And I said to myself, I know where we can store that food free of charge in the wrinkled stomachs of the millions of God's children all over the world who go to bed hungry at night. And maybe we spend far too much of our national budget establishing military bases around the world rather than bases of genuine concern and understanding. But not only do we see poverty abroad, I would remind you that in our own nation, there are about 40 million people who are poverty-stricken. I have seen them here and there. I've seen them in the ghettos of the North. And I've seen them in the rural areas of the South. I've seen them in Appalachia. I've just been in the process of touring in many areas of our country. And I must confess that in some situations, I have literally found myself crying. I was in Marks, Mississippi the other day, which is in Quitman County, the poorest county in the United States. I tell you, I saw hundreds of little black boys and black girls walking the streets with no shoes to wear. I saw their mothers and their fathers trying to carry on a little Head Start program, but they had no money. The federal government hadn't funded them. They were trying to carry on, and they raised a little money here and there, trying to get a little food to feed the children, trying to teach them a little something. And I saw mothers and fathers who said to me, not only were they unemployed, but they didn't get any kind of income, no old age pension, no welfare check or anything. I said, how do you live? And they say, well, we go around to the neighbors and ask them for a little something. When the berry season comes, we pick berries. When the rabbit season comes, we hunt and catch a few rabbits. And that's about it. And I was in Newark and Harlem just this week. And I walked in to the homes of welfare mothers. I saw them in conditions, no, not with wall-to-wall carpet, but wall-to-wall rats and roaches. I stood in an apartment. And this welfare mother said to me, the landlord will not repair this place. I've been here 2 years, and he hadn't made a single repair. She pointed out her little boy who was a victim of lead poisoning. She pointed out the walls with all of the ceiling falling through. She showed me the holes where the rats came in. And she said, night after night, we have to stay awake to keep the rats and the roaches from getting to the children. I said, how much do you pay for this apartment? She said, $125. And I looked and I thought and said to myself, it isn't worth $60. Poor people are forced to pay more for less. Living in conditions day in and day out where the whole area is constantly drained without being replenished, it becomes a kind of domestic colony. And the tragedy is so often these 40 million people are invisible because America is so affluent, so rich. Because our expressways carry us away from the ghetto, we don't see the poor. Jesus told a parable one day And he reminded us that a man went to hell because he didn't see the poor. His name was Dives. He was a rich man. And there was a man by the name of Lazarus who was a poor man, but not only was he poor, he was sick. Sores were all over his body. And he was so weak that he could hardly move. But he managed to get to the gate of Dives every day, wanting just to have the crumbs that would fall from his table. Dives did nothing about it. And the parable ends saying, Dives went to hell, and there was a fixed gulf now between Lazarus and Dives. And that is nothing in that parable which says that Dives went to hell because he was rich. Jesus never made a universal indictment against all wealth. It is true that one day a rich young ruler came to him and he advised him to sell all. But in that instance, Jesus was prescribing individual surgery and not setting forth a universal diagnosis. And if you will look at that parable with all of its symbolism, you will remember that a conversation took place between heaven and hell. And on the other end of that long distance call between heaven and hell was Abraham in heaven, talking to Dives in hell. Now, Abraham was a very rich man. If you go back to the Old Testament, you see that he was the richest man of his day. So it was not a rich man in hell talking with a poor man in heaven. It was a little millionaire in hell talking with a multimillionaire in heaven. Dives didn't go to hell because he was rich. Dives didn't realize that his wealth was his opportunity. It was his opportunity to bridge the gulf that separated him from his brother Lazarus. Dives went to hell because he passed by Lazarus every day and he never really saw him. He went to hell because he allowed his brother to become invisible. Dives went to hell because he maximized the minimum and minimized the maximum. Indeed, Dives went to hell because he sought to be a conscientious objector in the war against poverty. And this can happen to America, the richest nation in the world. There's nothing wrong with that. This is America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will. In a few weeks, some of us are coming to Washington to see if the will is still alive or if it is alive in this nation. We're coming to Washington in a poor people's campaign. Yes, we're going to bring the tired, the poor, the huddled masses. We're going to bring those who have known long years of hurt and neglect. We're going to bring those who've come to feel that life is a long and desolate corridor with no exit sign. We're going to bring children and adults and old people. People who've never seen a doctor or a dentist in their lives. We're not coming to engage in any histrionic gesture. We're not coming to tab Washington. We're coming to demand that the government will address itself to the problem of poverty. We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists. We're coming to ask America to be true to the huge promissory note that it signed years ago. And we're coming to engage in dramatic, nonviolent action to call attention to the gulf between promise and fulfillment, to make the invisible visible. Why do we do it this way? We do it this way because it is our experience that the nation doesn't move around questions of genuine equality for the poor and for black people until it is confronted massively, dramatically, in terms of direct action. Great documents are here to tell us something should be done. We met here some years ago in the White House Conference on Civil Rights, and we came out with the same recommendations that we will be demanding in our campaign here, but nothing has been done. The President's Commission on Technology, Automation, and Economic Progress recommended these things some time ago. Nothing has been done. Even the urban coalition made up of mayors of most of the cities of our country and the leading businessmen have said that these things should be done. Nothing has been done. The Kerner Commission came out with its report just a few days ago and then made specific recommendations. Nothing has been done. And I submit that nothing will be done until people of goodwill put their bodies and their souls in motion. And it will be the kind of soul force brought into being as a result of this confrontation that I believe will make the difference. Yes, it will be a poor people's campaign. This is a question facing America. Ultimately, a great nation is a compassionate nation. America has not met its obligations and its responsibilities to the poor. One day, we will have to stand before the God of history, and we will talk in terms of things we've done. Yes, we will be able to say, we build gargantuan bridges to span the seas. We build gigantic buildings to kiss the skies. Yes, we made our submarines to penetrate oceanic depths. We brought into being many other things with our scientific and technological power. It seems that I can hear the God of history saying, that was not enough. But I was hungry, and ye fed me not. I was naked, and ye clothed me not. I was devoid of a decent sanitary house to live in, and ye provided no shelter for me. And consequently, you cannot enter the kingdom of greatness. If ye do it unto the least of these, my brethren, ye do it unto me. That's the question facing America today. And I want to say one other challenge that we face. It is simply that we must find an alternative to war and bloodshed. Anyone who feels, and there are still a lot of people who feel that way, that war can solve the social problems facing mankind, is sleeping through a revolution. President Kennedy said on one occasion, mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind. The world must hear this. I pray God that America will hear this before it is too late, because today we are fighting a war. I'm convinced that it is one of the most unjust wars that has ever been fought in the history of the world. Our involvement in the war in Vietnam has torn up the Geneva Accord. It has strengthened the military-industrial complex. It has strengthened the forces of reaction in our nation. It has put us against the self-determination of the vast majority of Vietnamese people and put us in a position of protecting a corrupt regime that is stacked against the poor. It has played havoc with our domestic destinies. And this day we are spending $500,000 to kill every Viet Cong soldier. Every time we kill one, we spend about $500,000, while we spend only $53 a year for every person characterized as poverty-stricken in the so-called poverty program, which is not even a good skirmish against poverty. But not only that, it has put us in a position of appearing to the world as an arrogant nation. And here we are 10,000 miles away from home, fighting for the so-called freedom of the Vietnamese people, when we've not even put our own house in order. And we force young black men and young white men to fight and kill in brutal solidarity. And yet when they come back home, they can't hardly live on the same block together. The judgment of God is upon us today. And we could go right down the line and see that something must be done. And something must be done quickly. We have alienated ourselves from other nations, so we end up morally and politically isolated in the world. There's not a single major ally to the United States of America that would dare send a troop to Vietnam, and so the only friends that we have now are a few client nations like Taiwan, Thailand, South Korea, and a few others. This is where we are. Mankind must put an end to war. A war will put an end to mankind. And the best way to start is to put an end to the war in Vietnam, because if it continues, we will inevitably come to the point of confronting China, which could lead the whole world to nuclear annihilation. It is no longer the choice, my friends, between violence and nonviolence. It is either nonviolence or nonexistence, and the alternative to disarmament, the alternative to a greater suspension of nuclear tests, the alternative to strengthening the United Nations and thereby disarming the whole world, may well be a civilization plunged into the abyss of annihilation, and our earthly habitat will be transformed into an inferno that even the mind of Dante could not imagine. This is why I felt the need of raising my voice against that war, and working wherever I can to arouse the conscience of our nation on it. I remember so well when I first took a stand against the war in Vietnam. The critics took me on, and they had their say in the most negative and sometimes most vicious way. One day a newsman came to me and said, "Dr. King, don't you think you're going to have to stop now opposing the war and move more in line with the administration's policy? Because I understand that it has hurt the budget of your organization, and people who once respect you have lost respect. People who once respected you have lost respect for you. Don't you feel that you really got to change your position?" I looked at him and I had to say, "Sir, I'm sorry, you don't know me. I'm not a consensus leader. I do not determine what is right and wrong by looking at the budget of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. about taking a sort of Gallup poll of the majority opinion? Ultimately, a genuine leader is not a searcher for consensus, but a mold of consensus. On some positions, cowardice asks the question, is expedient? And then expediency comes along and asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? And conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular. But he must do it because conscience tells him it is right. And I believe today that there is a need for all people of goodwill to come with a massive act of conscience and say, in the words of the old Negro spiritual, we ain't gonna study war no more. This is the challenge facing modern man. Let me close by saying that we have difficult days ahead in the struggle for justice and peace. But I will not yield to a politic of despair. I'm going to maintain hope. As we come to Washington in this campaign, the cards are stacked against us. This time we will really confront a Goliath. And God grant that we will be that David of truth set out against the Goliath of injustice, the Goliath of neglect, the Goliath of refusing to deal with the problems, and go on with the determination to make America the truly great America that it is called to be. I say to you that our goal is freedom, and I believe we're going to get there, because however much she strays away from it, the goal of America is freedom. Abused and scorned though we may be as a people, our destiny is tied up in the destiny of America. Before the Pilgrim Fathers landed at Plymouth, we were here. Before Jefferson etched across the pages of history the majestic words of the Declaration of Independence, we were here. Before the beautiful words of the Star-Spangled Banner were written, we were here. And for more than two centuries, our forebears labored here without wages. They made cotton king, and they built the homes of their masters in the midst of the most humiliating and oppressive conditions. And yet out of a bottomless vitality, they continued to grow and develop. If the inexpressible cruelties of slavery couldn't stop us, the opposition that we now face will surely fail. We're going to win our freedom because both the sacred heritage of our nation and the eternal will of the Almighty God are embodied in our echoing demands. And so however dark it is, however deep the angry feelings are and the violent explosions are, I can still sing, we shall overcome. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. As we were singing earlier today, truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. And behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mounting of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. Thank God for John, who centuries ago out on a lonely, obscure island called Patmos caught vision of the new Jerusalem descending out of heaven from God. who heard a voice saying, "Behold, I make all things new. Former things are passed away. God grant that we will be participants in this newness and this magnificent development. If we will but do it, we will bring about a new day of justice and brotherhood and peace. And that day the morning stars will sing together, and the sons of God will shout for joy." God bless you.
Direct from our newsroom in Washington, in Tully, this is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite and Russ Hodge in Memphis, Tennessee, Dan Rather in New York, Bernard Kalb in Saigon, Marvin Kalb in Wellington, New Zealand, and Bert Quint in Quezon, South Vietnam.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Officers also reportedly chased and fired on a radio-equipped car containing two white men. Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. In the friend's words, the bullet exploded in his face. Police, who have been keeping a close watch over the Nobel Peace Prize winner because of Memphis' turbulent racial situation, were on the scene almost immediately. They rushed the 39-year-old Negro leader to a hospital where he died of a bullet wound in the neck. Police said they found a high-powered hunting rifle about a block from the hotel, but it was not immediately identified as the murder weapon. Mayor Henry Loeb has reinstated the dusk-to-dawn curfew he imposed on the city last week when a march led by Dr. King erupted in violence. Governor Buford Ellington has called out 4,000 National Guardsmen, and police report that the murder has touched off sporadic acts of violence in a Negro section of the city. In a nationwide television address, President Johnson expressed the nation's shock.
America is shocked and saddened by the brutal slaying tonight of Dr. Martin Luther King. I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King, who lived by nonviolence.
Dr. King had returned to Memphis only yesterday, determined to prove that he could lead a peaceful mass march in support of striking sanitation workers, most of whom are Negroes. Dr. King had this to say last night about the situation in Memphis.
"Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right."
There was shock in Harlem tonight when word of Dr. King's murder reached the nation's largest Negro community. Men, women, and children poured into the streets. They appeared dazed. Many were crying. A young Negro said, "Dr. King didn't really have to go back to Memphis. Maybe he wanted to prove something."
"We want to do a tune written for today, for this hour, for Dr. Martin Luther King. We stated before that the whole program is dedicated to his memory, but this tune is written about him and for him, and so we had yesterday to learn it, and so we'll see." "Once upon this planet Earth lived a man of humble birth, preaching love and freedom for his fellow men. He was dreaming of the day peace would come to earth to stay. And he spread this message all across the land. Turn the other cheek, he'd plead. Love thy neighbor was his creed. Pain, humiliation, death, he did not dread. With his Bible at his side, from his foes he did not hide. It's hard to think that this great man is dead. Oh yeah. Well, the murders never cease. Are they men or are they beasts? What do they ever hope? Ever hope to gain? Will my country stand or fall? Is it too late for us all? And did Martin Luther King just die in vain? Cause he'd seen the mountaintop, and he knew he could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better stop and think, cause we're headed for the brink. What will happen now that he is dead? He was for equality for all people, you and me. Full of love and goodwill, hate was not his way. He was not a violent man. Bigotry had sealed his face. All shed tears, but it won't change a thing. Teach your people, will they ever learn? Must you always kill with burn and burn with guns and kill with guns and burn? Don't you know how we got to react? You know what it will bring. But he had seen the mountaintop, and he knew he could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better stop and think. Everybody knows we're on the brink. What will happen now that Martin the King did. I'm gonna say he'd seen the mountaintop, and he knew he could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better stop and think and feel again. Are we headed for the brink? What's gonna happen now in all of our cities? Our people are rising. They're living in lies, even if they have to die. Even if they have to die at the moment that they know what life is. Even at that one moment that you know what life is, if you have to die, it's all right, 'cause you know what life is. You know what freedom is for one moment of your life. What's gonna happen now that the King of Love? I heard that, we've heard all kinds of stories, but I heard that this was his favorite song, at least near the end of his life. Last year, a year ago, maybe more longer than that now, Lorraine Hansberry left us, and she was a dear friend. And she had her favorite song, and then Langston Hughes left us, Coltrane left us, Otis Redding left us. You can go on. Do you realize how many we have lost? Then it really gets down to reality, doesn't it? Not a performance. Not microphones and all that crap. But really something else. We've lost a lot of them in the last 2 years. But we have remaining Monk, Miles. I love you too. And of course, for those that we have left, we're thankful, but we can't afford any more losses. Oh no. Oh my God. They're shooting us down one by one. Don't forget that. Because they are. Killing us one by one. Well, all I have to say is that those of us who know how to protect those of us that we love, stand by them and stay close to them. And I say that if there'd been a couple more, a little closer to Dr. King, he wouldn't have got it. You know, really. Just a little closer to him. Stay there. Stay there. We can't afford any more losses. He had seen mountaintop, and he knew he could not stop. Always living with a threat. Dead ahead. Come on, Sam.